Today on Against the Grain. While the Trump administration has pointedly targeted dissent at universities, sharp conflict between administrators, board members, and many student staff and faculty have roiled colleges and universities for much longer. Economic sociologist Charlie Eaton reflects on how powerful financiers have transformed higher education well beyond elite institutions, while burdening students with high levels of debt. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The U.S. government's attacks on universities has been a key pillar of the Trump agenda. And according to Charlie Eaton, universities' response to the attacks, capitulation by some and resistance from others, exposes long-standing divisions inside higher education. Eaton is Associate Professor of Sociology at UC Merced. In Bankers in the Ivory Tower, The Troubling Rise of Financiers in U.S. Higher Education, he writes about how hedge fund managers, investment bankers, and private equity firms have reshaped higher education from elite universities at the top to for-profit colleges at the bottom. The Trump administration's assault on higher education is often framed as a channeling of sorts of working-class resentment against elite universities. Charlie, why do you think that misunderstands the motivations for the attacks?
Well, one place to go to that is the story of Marc Andreessen, the venture capitalist billionaire from Silicon Valley, whose partner Ben Horowitz used to be on the board of Columbia University. And he started, during COVID, he started these secret Chatham House chat groups with other Silicon Valley elites and financiers, and also some right-wing thinkers like Christopher Rufo, who's been one of the architects of the Trump attacks on higher education, Ben Shapiro, others. And one of the ways that Andreessen has narrated his anger at elite universities is not as a champion of some working class base of Trump voters, but as somebody whose business model in crypto and in artificial intelligence investment has felt threatened by progressive policy proposals that he sees as coming out of universities. And he also talks about tech executives and himself as the leader of one of the largest venture capital firms in the world as increasingly seeing a large portion of their elite educated employees as woke and angry at the company angry at the company's dominance by white men in leadership, or the company's inattentiveness to things like climate change or the social impacts of their for-profit business model. So I think there's actually, a lot of motivation here among the economic allies of the Trump administration attacks is about perceived threats to their own social status and their own economic welfare that they see coming out of universities and liberal education, not so much for the working class at these universities, but for the children of elites who mostly go to our most selective private universities.
Well, as you've just said, universities serve multiple purposes, and there's the whole world of culture and status that is so important for elite universities in terms of those on the top. But I wanted to ask you, what role do colleges and universities play beyond those things for those in the financial sector? How, or why, I should say, are colleges and universities especially lucrative for them?
I mean, there's a couple of things. One is that especially early in the rise of private equity and venture capital firms, which have produced the greatest wealth on Wall Street and in Silicon Valley over the last 40 years, in their early days in the 1980s and 1990s, university endowments were one of their biggest sources of investment capital. So they would raise capital from university endowments and go use it to invest in the things that they invested in to try to make money. So that's one part of the story. And another part of the story is that elite university alumni networks, but especially the boards of elite universities, provide social ties to other business elites from which you can get really valuable information and connections and political influence that you can use to guide your investments. So Michael Lewis, the famous author who wrote Liar's Poker about Wall Street and also The Big Short about the short selling of mortgage-backed securities in the financial crisis. He in the early 90s wrote a story about David Rubenstein, who's the founder of Carlyle, one of the largest private equity firms, and who's also the chair of the board of trustees at University of Chicago. And it was called Access Capitalism. And it was about how a lot of, the Carlyle and Rubenstein put a lot of people from government on their board, or people who revolved through government, especially around defense, and did so in order to have not necessarily illegal, but valuable inside private information about things that could, for their investments in heavily subsidized government, government subsidized areas. And so that's another reason. And so what we've seen over the last 40 years, because of this particular value of elite ties for financiers, is that the share of university board members coming from finance has gone steadily up. To the point where they, financiers make up over a quarter of all elite private university board members. At some elite universities like Columbia, they've made up more than 40% of the board. At Penn, they make up, more than 40% of the board. And they particularly come from private equity and from hedge funds. And in private equity, I include venture capital in that. And, the last thing is these folks have become very wealthy. And if you're on a university board, you donate. One of the prerequisites for being on the board is donating a lot of money and raising a lot of money from your wealthy friends. And so as these folks have become the wealthiest group of Americans, they've had more money to donate. But it's not just that. If you do some fancy math and some regression analyses, and you test for it, they actually have more board members, board seats on our elite university boards than you'd even expect based on their wealth, and more board seats than other billionaires. So if you look at the Forbes 400 wealthiest billionaires, those Forbes 400 folks who are from private equity and hedge funds, they serve on the elite boards at much higher rates than the other billionaires do.
Well, let's step back and talk about how we got to where we are now. How were universities primarily funded in the United States through much of the 20th century before the neoliberal turn that began in the 1970s and that deregulated much of finance?
So if you go back, the sort of modern university system really comes about in the 50s and even to a greater extent in the 60s. And the expansion of universities is funded in large part by growing federal spending and growing state spending on higher education. And that spending doesn't just go to public universities. It also goes to private universities, including elite private universities, via things like first the GI Bill for returning soldiers to fund them to go to universities. There was some resistance at elite universities to enrolling students from working class backgrounds funded by the GI Bill, with the University of Chicago president at the time saying they didn't want the university campus to become a hobo jungle. But then beyond the GI Bill, you had a big increase in federal funding for working class students to go to college under the 1965 Higher Education Act, which was actually passed as part of the Great Society and the War on Poverty. It's less well known by most Americans. And that created our modern grant funding programs, Pell Grants, which pay for working class students to go to college, including at elite universities. Up through the 1970s, those programs paid for a larger share of college costs than they do today. So you could mostly go to college, even at an elite school, with support from a Pell Grant. And then the last thing is we had a huge expansion of federal research grant funding, both around defense and general scientific research, the creation of the National Science Foundation in the 1950s, but also around health and health research and the creation of the National Institutes for Health and research grant funding for universities to do health research. So that combination created this huge amount of funding that expanded really mass higher education, particularly at public universities. And still today, public universities do the lion's share of education for most students. 70% of students who earn a bachelor's degree in the U.S. Do so, around 70% do so at a public university. And elite private universities really enroll a very tiny fraction of students. And those students that they do enroll are disproportionately from the very wealthy.
Well, before we talk more about how higher education was restructured, I wonder if you could discuss how U.S. elites viewed colleges and universities coming out of the huge social upheavals of the 1960s and 70s, given them that so much of that was actually based on campuses.
One thing that I can talk about as a Californian who knows the UC system very well and its history is, you really had a pretty calculated backlash led by Governor Reagan and President Nixon to characterize universities as out of control, as places of wild drug use and drug experimentation and political radicalism that were a threat to law and order. Now, how did business elites see it? Were they in lockstep with Reagan and Nixon? It would make sense to me. I don't have a great command of how business elites in that era saw it, but that was very much a big strand of right-wing and Republican political discourse in the late 60s and 70s. And the other part of the discourse was, a perception of threats from schools increasingly enrolling Black students and other non-white students. Schools were very, very white, very restrictive racially up until the 1960s. And the creation of affirmative action policies and also student unrest to demand more racial equality in college admissions and college access created a substantial growing access, and particularly in the 60s and 70s, for students of color. And, there's some signs in the discourse of the right not wanting to fund higher education for those racial others. While there was more support for funding higher education across the political spectrum when it was mostly something that white middle class students would benefit from, you start to see a sort of othering of who's getting the benefits of higher education as higher education access becomes more diverse.
Economic sociologist Charlie Eaton is my guest. He is the author of Bankers in the Ivory Tower, The Troubling Rise of Financiers in U.S. Higher Education. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you write that in the early 1990s, commercial bankers pushed for greater expansion of federal student loan programs with significant consequences for higher education. Can you tell us what the backdrop of that was, what was happening to student funding or university funding generally, and how did they go about making this significant change to the funding of higher education?
Yeah, so if you go back to, you know, the end of the 1970s is sort of the heyday for publicly funded higher education and higher education affordability for all. At the end of the 1970s, most students who went to college were eligible for Pell Grant funds. Pell Grants being the grant that you can just use to pay your tuition, but also your cost of living while you're going to college. And it would cover most of your college costs, particularly at public universities. And again, it was not just a program for low-income students, it was also a middle-class program. So most people could use it. Only 1 in 8 students who went to college in the 1970s took out a student loan. But at the end of the 1970s, in the Carter administration, but then even more so at the beginning of the Reagan administration, you get a real evisceration of the Pell Grant program, pushed by the Reagan administration, but abetted by the Democrats who controlled both the House and the Senate. And you also have early challenges for states to fund public universities. And so at this time, even university leaders, university administrators, and the leaders of their trade associations who go and represent them in Washington said their preferred way to continue funding higher education and providing access is to restore the Pell Grant funding. And they even in congressional testimony expressed wariness about student loans because of how they worried that it would compromise access and also make it harder for them to get grant funding as their preferred funding method. So in come the commercial bankers and their trade group to say, well, we could do something else. Instead of funding it with grants to students, we could fund it with loans. And the loans wouldn't be made by the federal government. They would be made by private banks. But if we're going to make those loans, we want the federal government to give us something called guarantees. And the guarantees essentially say, if the student doesn't pay back the loan because they don't make enough money, because they have a health problem, they aren't able to work, the federal government will pay back the loans. And so they pushed this policy, and it took them really a decade to get the policy fully adopted. But they do so by 1992, get a massive expansion of federal student loans passed with these subsidies for private banks to do most of the lending. And that really opens the door for colleges to say, okay, we can increase tuition by having students use more of these loans to pay for college, have more of our students use loans, and also have higher tuition with higher loan rates. And particularly at private universities, and even more so at for-profit colleges, you then get a huge expansion of student debt under these new federally subsidized student loan programs.
Right. And you argue that in Bankers in the Ivory Tower, you argue that when we look at the ways that finance has reshaped higher education, we need to make sure to look at it at the different sort of levels of strata of higher education, because the range is quite different, right, between what takes place at elite universities, what takes place in the public universities that so many people get their degrees at, and then also these for-profit private colleges. And I wonder if you can talk about how that expansion of the federal student loan program affected those different layers of higher education, starting with the elite.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I call them three strata, right? The top strata being the elite strata, bottom strata being the for-profit colleges, and then public universities being the sort of the big middle strata. And it takes elite colleges a little while to figure out what they're doing. So you have a You actually have a substantial expansion of student loan borrowing at elite colleges, both for undergrads and for grad and professional students in the 1990s. But then starting around the 2000s, the elite universities realize, well, wait, our endowments have been growing so fast that we can actually make college very low debt or even debt-free for almost all of our undergrads. And so starting in the 2000s onward, you get a big decline at the most elite universities and elite liberal arts colleges and student loan borrowing. The other thing that goes on at the elite colleges is that a lot of the students who go there are wealthy. I think as Raj Chetty shows, he shows, I think for it's around 40 of the most elite colleges, they enroll more students from the top 1% of the income spectrum than from the bottom 60% combined. And those students from the top 1%, they don't have to take out student loans to be able to afford to go to college. And then for those, the small number of lower income students at these elite schools, the endowments are large enough to provide enough financial aid. Now, one of the reasons they're large enough to provide enough financial aid is because the elite schools, they just don't enroll that many students, and they don't enroll that many students who are from working class backgrounds. So, if you only enroll five students from low income backgrounds, it's pretty easy to offer debt-free college education. One way I like to illustrate this is that University of California, Berkeley, in most of the last decade, in most years, has enrolled more low-income Pell Grant recipients than the entire Ivy League combined. And that's just UC Berkeley, not the UC system. So that's the top. Then at the bottom, for-profit colleges say, okay, we can charge students really large tuition rates at zero upfront cost to the students and tell the students that they shouldn't worry about taking out the loan because they're going to make more money to the point that they'll be able to pay off the loan easily. And with financing from private equity, for-profit colleges do a huge expansion of their enrollments from the 1990s onward, going from enrolling around 500,000 students to over 2 million students a year. Their enrollments grow from 5 to 10% of all college enrollments in the US, and they rack up the highest predatory debts by far. And then in the middle, public universities are, I describe them as squeezed, and they're squeezed for a couple reasons. One is that the federal student loan programs that were expanded in the 1990s had these huge subsidies. And so instead of providing grants to low-income students to go to public universities as we had in the past, grant funding gets diverted to the subsidies for the banks that are doing most of the federal student lending. And so that diverts money or that could go to students going to public universities. And then they also, there's resources diverted to the top because of tax subsidies for the endowments, because endowments are allowed to operate tax-free, even though private universities receive substantial public benefits. And those tax exemptions come at a large cost, around $20 billion a year, that again could be used to fund public universities. Or could be used to encourage elite private universities to enroll more students and more students from working class backgrounds, as public universities have done.
Well, in your book, you look at the University of California to understand the dynamic that you've just been describing of the way that public institutions have been squeezed. Can you tell us about how the expansion of loans and the financing of education through loans has played out at the University of California?
Yeah, so there was a big expansion in student loan borrowing in California, particularly in the UC system, and and to some and to a significant extent in the California State University system in the 1990s and 2000s. Since 2010, that is, you know, both because federal loans are offered and expanded in place of expanded Pell Grants, but also because of state funding cuts to the UC system, or at the least we might say state funding that doesn't keep up with enrollment growth. And what you then end up happening is, you know, a growth in the percent of students who borrow, and you particularly have a surge during the financial crisis from 2007 to 2009, when there were very steep and abrupt funding cuts to the UC system, in part because of student protest and pushback, and that helped fuel the passage of the Proposition 30 tax initiative in 2012. You actually get a refunding of the University of California and CSU systems from 2012 onward. And that ends up having kind of uneven effects on student debt in the UC system. And so at least, you know, that refunding and a tuition freeze that was put in place for about a decade following 2012, at least arrests the growth of student debt in the UC system. But also mirroring that inequality across the private public system nationally, you get a decline in student loan borrowing at the top of the UC system. So students at UCLA and UC Berkeley borrow less today, and UC Berkeley and UCLA are trying to become student debt free as some of their elite counterparts like Stanford have, but have tried to do so while enrolling many, many more working class students than Stanford does. The CSUs, or at the, you know, the lower end of the resource and status spectrum of the UC system, like my campus, UC Merced, student loan debt has been a much more persistent problem than at the top of the UC system.
You mentioned for-profit colleges and that those have grown and they have been where many working class students go to get a college education. Can you talk more about how those students in particular ended up with highest levels of debt and were most vulnerable to the kind of targeting of finance?
Yeah, and I think I'd like to do that by sharing a story that I tell in the book. And the story involves a few students who end up going to the New England Institute of Art, a for-profit college. And it also involves Jonathan Nelson, a board member of Brown University and the founder of Providence Equity Capital, who's Rhode Island's only billionaire. And you know, the story in a way actually starts with Jonathan Nelson, whose firm, Providence Equity Capital, partners with Goldman Sachs and another boutique private equity firm in the 2000s to do the largest ever leveraged buyout of a for-profit college company. For over $2 billion, they acquire EDMC, the education management company, which ran the Art Institute's chain. And after acquiring EDMC, they made a real emphasis on scaling up the universities, pumping lots of money into advertising and recruitment and recruiters, while cutting spending on a per student basis for instruction and student support. And among the students who get sucked in is Kim Tran, who grew up literally only miles from Jonathan Nelson in Rhode Island. And she ends up going to this school and ends up taking on $30,000 in debt, but is never able to finish a degree because there's just not adequate instructional support or training. The university has really been hollowed out. And she's recruited on the basis of these premises that, yeah, you'll take out this student loan that you're really nervous about and that your family as Vietnamese immigrants is really nervous about. But you'll be able to pay it off no problem because you're going to get a great job that will help place you. Typically, these art schools would have placed people with graphic design firms or marketing firms to do applied arts. And that never happens for Kim. And so she still had her $30,000 loan until she actually was able to get it discharged under the Biden administration, under Biden administration policies that have been pushed by progressive student loan reformers. But it's a weird story because Jonathan Nelson is, you know, paints himself as a education philanthropist. He's donated over $50 million to Brown University. He's no longer on the board, but he served on the board for more than a decade. And yet he ends up, his donations to Brown are funded by operating a private equity business that does things like this acquisition and predatory transformation of the art institutes. And the other interesting part of this story about how this exploitation at the bottom is connected to the wealth and inequality at the top is that when Jonathan Nelson did this private equity buyout of EDMC, they did so with endowment investments from in their private equity fund from more than 14 different university endowments. And I don't think any of those universities had an intention that they were going to be investing in predatory for-profit colleges when they invested with Jonathan Nelson's firm. But I think this illustrates how the sort of modern, what I call a social circuitry of finance, connects endowment hoarding at the top of universities to this exploitation at the bottom with for-profit colleges.
Charlie Eaton is my guest. He's an associate professor of sociology at UC Merced. We're discussing Bankers in the Ivory Tower, the troubling rise of financiers in U.S. higher education. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So one of the things that you've been mentioning, Charlie, and certainly has been in the news a lot in this tumultuous year for higher education, is the endowments that universities have. And I wondered if you could just spell out for us what they're there for public institutions, for private ones, and how do they function?
Yeah, so, you know, if you go back to their origins, the idea of endowments was they were in order to preserve the institutions over long periods of time. And there was a principle, they called it intergenerational equity, where the idea is you preserve the endowment so that you can provide the same amount of social and educational benefit for future generations as you do for the current generation. But that idea of intergenerational equity became a bit silly from the 1980s onward. And that was because of a change in endowment investment practices. They went from investing in very conservative investment vehicles like bonds or just conventional stock portfolios like mutual funds to investing with private equity and hedge funds in the 1980s. They made that shift because of some deregulations of financial investment and because they were coming out of some financially difficult times in the late 60s and early 1970s. And so you, starting the 1980s onward, you end up getting 10% rates of return for elite university endowments. And I think the best way to explain what that translates to is to look at Princeton University, because Princeton University doesn't have any law school. It doesn't operate a hospital, where it's a lot of other elite universities. If they've got a hospital or a law school, they're doing these other things that are also funded by the endowment that makes it a little bit harder to think about the endowment on a per student basis. But if you take the example of Princeton, where they don't have a hospital or a law school or a business school, Princeton's endowment goes from a couple of billion in the 1970s to over $30 billion today. And if you And because Princeton, like most universities, spends about 5% of its endowment per year on university operations, it ends up going from spending about $10,000 per student from the endowment in the 1970s to spending $180,000 per student or so today. And so that's not including what Princeton spends from its tuition revenue or its research grants. Just from the endowment, it spends about $180,000 per student. Part of that is the huge growth of the endowment through those 10% annual rates of return and donations from wealthy supporters. But another part of it is that Princeton just doesn't increase its enrollment from the 1970s onward, even as its endowment has grown so spectacularly. And that's very different than public universities. You know, even at the university level, University of California, Berkeley, dramatically expanded its enrollment from the 1970s onward.
Well, I wonder if you could spell out for us what the connection is between the massive growth of these endowments and the growth of student debt. I guess thinking in the big picture, not just at, you know, one single institution.
Yeah. So if you kind of pan out to the big picture, but maybe still using Princeton to think about this, is if you've got this huge amount of wealth at Princeton, but they're only enrolling at less than 1,000 new undergraduates every year, that means that endowment can only be used to provide a debt-free education to a handful of students. It also means, because of all the tax subsidies that Princeton receives and tax exemptions that it receives for operating its endowment, it means that there's less tax revenue to fund public universities. And so the public universities and the for-profit colleges and the less elite private colleges that enroll most students, they just don't have these resources. Whereas our wealthiest endowments, the Harvards, the Princetons, the MITs, the Stanfords, collectively have endowments valued over $100 billion, just at those, what they would call the big five of the five wealthiest schools. And so you've got a lot of resources that are being hoarded at those schools and not used at the schools that are enrolling a lot of students from across the social and economic spectrum. And so I think part of the attack on elite universities by the Trump administration has been opportunistic. They've passed new taxes on university endowments, including in the Trump tax bill, but they haven't used the tax revenue from that to fund expanded educational access to public universities or other schools. Instead, what they've done is used it to fund tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And I think that progressives, university leaders, the Democratic Party bears some responsibility for that, because they all ignored the inequalities involving endowments at their own peril and left a space open for the Trump administration and President Trump to opportunistically use endowment taxes to advance his own agenda and his own war on science and free speech.
So Charlie Eaton, you've been discussing the myriad ways that universities have been financialized over the past decades. And, you know, you're talking right now about university endowments. So there are those who, you know, have referred to some of the elite universities as hedge funds that also teach classes, that much of the university is kind of driven by the interests of private capital within the university. You've been discussing, of course, the ways that student debt has allowed for an explosion of profits for those in commercial banking. And you mentioned the for-profit colleges, where often those students end up with debt. I wonder if you could talk more about how the for-profit colleges also represent, in other ways, a vehicle for finance to profit from higher education.
The key way that for-profit colleges offer opportunities for finance is that private equity firms and other financiers who invest in publicly traded for-profit college companies are able to net profits from those organizations that are largely funded by federal subsidies and by predatory loans to students. And that really reaches its peak in 2012. The ability of for-profit financiers to do that for for-profit colleges was left open by a total absence of consumer protection regulations that progressives were able to pass a set of pretty good consumer protection regulations under the Obama administration that led to a big fall in for-profit college enrollments from 2012 onward. But before that fall, particularly, financiers were able to extract huge profits by saddling students with literally tens of billions of dollars in student loans and by extracting tens of billions of dollars in federal Pell Grant subsidies that they could charge from students as tuition and then pass on to investors in the for-profit colleges from Wall Street. And so I used the example of Jonathan Nelson before, but this continues. Today, Mark Rowan, the CEO of Apollo, is benefiting from Apollo's investments in the University of Phoenix, a kind of famously predatory for-profit college, which was acquired by Mark Rowan's Apollo private equity group. And it all comes kind of full circle in that Mark Rowan has also been very involved in the Trump administration's attacks on universities. And Rowan also sits on the board of advisors for the Penn Wharton School, where he's an alumnus.
Charlie Eaton, I want to turn to the present that you've just alluded to, which is under the second Trump administration. Obviously, there have been a absolute assault on higher education. And in the early days, you know, really kind of stunning capitulation by many universities like Columbia. We're seeing more resistance more recently, obviously Harvard, recent news about MIT and Brown saying no to some of Trump's constraints for funding. I wonder if you could tell us how you understand that combination of capitulation and resistance and what that means about the kind of struggles that are existing, that are taking place within the universities themselves in terms of those who run the universities, those who do the work, those who finance them, and so on.
I think about what's going on as what I would call an elite war over higher education, in which, you know, who has what power in universities is varied across universities. So as we've been talking about, financiers who sit on the boards of trustees of universities have a lot of power in universities, but they don't have all of the power and they don't have uniform power across every university. Faculty also are important constituencies who can shape what the university does. University administrators who may have dependencies on their elite financier trustees for fundraising and for the formal governance role of boards. Students have power by speaking out and raising their voices and engaging with those other constituencies. And we see a contestation, particularly at our elite universities, about whether they're going to continue to have free speech and be bastions of free speech in an era where we have a president who is attacking democracy, attacking core freedoms that we've taken for granted for a long time. And so I think if you look at places like Columbia, where they capitulated pretty early on to the president, you saw to a greater extent, significant power exercised by elite financier trustees. I mentioned Mark Andreessen earlier of the Andreessen Horowitz venture capital firm. His partner, Ben Horowitz, used to serve on the board of trustees at Columbia, has a lot of ties on the Columbia board, and is part of the milieu that pressured Columbia to capitulate to President Trump's attacks. On the other hand, we've had pretty good reporting out of the New York Times that some of the elites on Harvard's board have really seen this as a threat, Trump's attacks as a threat to universities that needs to be resisted as a threat to American society in general. And so people like Penny Pritzker, who herself comes from finance, but has kind of a rooting in a different set of financial and political ties, whose brother is the governor of Illinois and has been speaking out against President Trump's National Guard deployments. She has decided and led Harvard to push back more than Columbia, perhaps not as much as some others would say, along with Alan Garber, the president of Harvard. The president of Princeton has been really important in trying to gather university administrators to resist. So I think what we see is a kind of uneven contestation where the extent of financier power at elite universities has mattered for how much universities have been prepared to push back.
Well, do you see those same dynamics at play preceding Trump? Because, you know, the dynamics you've been describing, both in terms of the outsized role at some universities of financiers and also these divisions within the university and kind of conflicts between different sectors of the university. Do you see those dynamics at play with the crackdown on dissent around Israel? Because, of course, what we're seeing with Trump is, you know, massive, but the shutdown of dissent preceded the Trump administration.
Yeah, no, I think both the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the campus protests around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Trump administration's attacks on universities have in some ways made more visible who holds and exercises power at universities than had been previously visible. When things are just going along business as usual, it's hard to differentiate, you know, who's really exercising power and who's in control. But when you have protests and contestation, whether it's protests by students calling for university divestment from companies involved in the Israeli war in Gaza, or whether it's faculty and students calling for universities to resist Trump's demands to crack down on free speech or trans rights, that's when you really get to see power exercised. And so I think the power of financiers has become more visible, including the financiers like Mark Rowan, like Bill Ackman, who have been very involved in pressuring universities to crack down on free speech around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I'd like to end by asking you about something which may seem utopian to be discussing in this political climate, but nevertheless needs to be asked, which is, what could be done to change the power of financiers in the universities, public, private, and to help ameliorate the situation that so many students find themselves in, absolutely burdened with student debt?
Part of it is, you know, how do we reduce the dependence, the financial dependence of our most elite universities on their endowments and on financier donors? You know, the Trump administration in some ways has, I think, made us all think twice about what kind of policy requirements should you have for private universities that receive substantial public subsidies. Because the Trump administration is using public subsidies to leverage private universities to adopt a very reactionary anti-free speech agenda. And so I think the pluralism of our universities and the independence of our universities is very important. But we need to think about, when we give large subsidies to universities, what are the expectations that we have for them to support the rights of all, and to provide educational benefits that are broadly accessible? And how do we fund them in a way where they're not dependent on financier donations and endowments? The other thing is to rethink university governance and to say, shouldn't we have university boards that aren't just reflective of the donor class to universities, but reflect all of the constituencies that universities serve or that universities should serve, whether it's their surrounding communities, whether it's students, whether it's faculty or alumni. And so those two broad areas of governance reform and funding higher education in a different way, I think, is important. And lastly, while we might want to encourage better practices at private universities, funding our public universities is really vital because they really do enroll the vast majority of students who go on to earn a bachelor's degree. And we need to provide them with sufficient funding so that they can offer debt-free education to their students from all backgrounds, so that it's not just wealthy kids or the lucky few who get into elite private school who can go to college debt-free.
Charlie Eaton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of Bankers in the Ivory Tower, The Troubling Rise of Financiers in U.S. Higher Education. Charlie Eaton is Associate Professor of Sociology at UC Merced. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast.